You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today has a diverse background that should interest a wide variety of our listeners. If you like agriculture, politics, movies, and even comedy, you'll like my guest. He's Dan Glickman. He's a former member of Congress, a cabinet secretary, and chair of the Motion Pictures Association of America, and he worked for a while at Harvard University. Now he's also an author. His recent book, Laughing at Myself, My Education in Congress, on the Farm and at the Movies, is an excellent read, and with our nation's birth date coming up, I think it's really an inspirational story about America and what makes our country special. Dan, thanks for taking the time to be on today.
Hey, it's a joy to be with you, Robin.
What an interesting life. Start off by just the title. So many books we read, biographies we read, are kind of filled with self-importance, and while your accomplishments are many, you kind of take more of a self-deprecating view.
Yeah, well, you know, I was lucky, fortunate to have two good parents, and they had this natural sense of humor, and both my mother and dad kind of conveyed to me, don't take yourself too seriously. And even as I got into politics, you know, I ran for the school board and Congress and was at USDA for years and wherever, they used to say, you're better off by not grabbing this concept of self-importance, which too many in politics seem to gravitate towards. So that's kind of been part of it, and I've just had that as part of my life and everything I've done.
Well, you had an interesting upbringing in Kansas, of all places, and here in the Midwest, the Heartland, and that's another thing that attracted me to this story. But talk about your upbringing in the Midwest and the values you grew up with, and how you got your start in elective politics.
Well, my grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, Jewish immigrants, and they came to Kansas, and my grandfather went into the oil field supply and scrap iron business a long time ago, and then my dad stayed in that business and ultimately went into the baseball business. We owned a AAA franchise of the Chicago Cubs, the Wichita Arrows, for many years. And I was always gravitated to politics. I'm not sure why. I think I'm a problem solver. I'm not a bomb thrower. So I'm not as comfortable with today's politics as I was back 30, 40, 50 years ago when most of us were trying to get things done. And so I see a lot of need for humor in politics. But certainly my Kansas roots, my being in Congress for all those years from the Wichita area, but being on the Agriculture Committee for most of that time, had a lot to do with my views on life, on politics, and on humor.
You know, it's interesting. I served on a city council of a town of about 10,000 for about 4 years, and you make a point here that I thought was really interesting and for our listeners to kind of be aware of, that folks with a background in local government seem to have qualities that lend themselves to be better lawmakers.
Well, you know, if you're in local government, whether you're on the city council or the school board, you have to get things done. I mean, they're just this constant barrage of heated rhetoric doesn't accomplish anything for people who want to get their streets paved or their protect against crime or having a decent quality of life. And so having that experience makes a big difference. What I find is that a lot of people in Congress today who don't have that local government experience have a harder time reaching consensus and working together.
So you were elected to the school board and decided to make a run for Congress. Share with our listeners a little bit about your district and how you approached the campaign. And this was in 1976, I believe, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, 76. So I've been on the school board in Wichita, which has had about 70% of the congressional district. So I was, you know, pretty well known, got a fair amount of publicity. And this was in the post-Watergate year in 1976. Remember, Nixon resigned in 74, and Democrats, I was a Democrat, and today there are very few Democrats in the state of Kansas. But back then, it was pretty evenly balanced. So I decided to run for Congress, And I made the calculated decision that even though Wichita, which was the largest city in the state, was the heart of my district, that I would focus on rural and agriculture counties because they knew me in Wichita, and I knew that I needed to build trust with people that didn't know me. So I spent, I'd say, 80% of my time in the Reno County and Sumner County, and these were Harvey County. These were big wheat-producing counties in central Kansas. And my dad had also, as I mentioned, he'd been in the oil business, so he had done a lot of business with farmers out in Kansas in terms of getting oil and gas leases and working with them, and he had built up some trust. So it turned out that when the election took place and I ran against an incumbent congressman, I defeated him largely because of big margins I carried in the rural counties. And in the urban counties of Wichita, I either split or just lost barely, but I got big victories in the wheat-producing counties. The farmers and ranchers came through for me.
And just to emphasize, you are a Democrat, ran as a Democrat in 76, and of course the parties are so much different now, but as I was reading the book, I mean, I knew you won, but I was waiting to see, well, I got crushed out in rural areas, but I won based on the urban vote, and it was just the opposite, and the hard work paid off.
It paid off, and then when I got elected, you know, and then it was unexpected. I was not on anybody's targeted list, so to speak, and kind of quiet. And back in those days, you didn't have to raise several million dollars to run for Congress. In fact, I raised a total of $100,000 total in my congressional race, which today you've got to raise $100,000 a day, basically,
yeah,
to run for office if you're lucky. And so when I got elected, my chief of staff, who was my campaign manager, said, "You got to go on the Agriculture Committee." And I said, "Well, what about the Appropriations Committee or the Ways and Means Committee or all these sexier committees?" And she says, "Nope. You won in rural America, and that's who you've got to serve." And it was kind of the smartest advice I ever got because I was then able to really focus on rural and agriculture issues to a large extent over the time I was in Congress, and then ultimately became Secretary of Agriculture. And certainly my experience in working on farm issues had a lot to do with that.
I just want to emphasize again for our listeners how different your campaign was. You didn't have to raise a boatload of money. $100,000 was a lot of money back then, but nothing compared to now. And the way you spent it and the way you approached the campaign was so different from today, instead of just putting TV ads on and hiring a bunch of consultants.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I had some TV, but it didn't start until September or October before the election, not like today. And, of course, we have social media today, and campaigns are so different. But I actually walked door to door. I must have walked 35,000 to 40,000 homes in my district, and my campaign staff, I think, sent me out because they thought I was a nervous, anxiety-prone person and thought walking would do me some good. And also lost a lot of weight in the process. I looked better than I ever did. But that door-to-door activity was a big difference, and people do not campaign for Congress that way anymore. You know, it's just all based on raising money, ads on TV, ads on social media. And the more money you raise, the more likely you're going to get support from national parties. Just a totally different world.
Do you think that could work? I mean, I want to give hope to, because I really think our politics are better the more door-to-door campaigning is done, where voters or candidates are in front of the voters. Do you think there's a chance that could still work, or is it just unrealistic that, you know, a candidate knocking all those doors, not raising the money, and they're just going to get overwhelmed with negative ads?
I think you got to do both, unfortunately. I think you got to raise money because television and media is still critical, although social media may not be quite as expensive as television and big-time television and radio. It depends what state you're in, although I met a woman running for Congress in the state of Illinois who talked about spending $5 to $8 million. I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's not, the job's not worth it. I was going to tell her to go do something else.
Yeah.
But I do also think that there needs to be more focus on voter-to-voter contact, door-to-door, town hall meetings, and the like, and you can do both.
Dan, once you got into Congress, it's so refreshing to read. And again, I consider myself more middle of the road, but the word bipartisanship wasn't a dirty word. You got some things accomplished because of that.
Well, I was lucky that, you know, I also had good people in my state delegation. So I had two great senators, Senators Bob Dole and Nancy Kassebaum. Dole, of course, was minority and majority leader, and Kassebaum was the daughter of a man who ran for president in 1936. And they were both what I call centrist Republicans, and they were problem solvers. I remember Bob Dole used to tell me, Glickman, you have 2 ears and 1 mouth for a simple reason. Remember that and you'll do better in your life. And so it was, there was partisanship back then. I'm not telling you it was totally heaven on earth, but we were pretty much geared to try to solve problems both for the state and for the country as a whole. And there's still a lot of that. Not everybody is a jerk. But it's just the nature of our political system today, the metastasis of money, the amount of negative media that's out there, the partisanship that exists, is much different than when I served.
What were some of your big accomplishments that you were able to get done for not only your district, because your focus as a congressman has to be on the folks back home, but also nationally? Every issue has national repercussions, of course.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there were a lot of different things. For my district, you know, all the agriculture and farm policy issues I worked on with Bob Dolan, Pat Roberts. I mean, we were known as the state that basically directed agriculture policy for years. I mean, it was really a pleasure. It was a lot of fun. And then, of course, I had to look out for my district. So I had Wichita was the home of all these airplane companies, Beech and Cessna and Learjet and Boeing Company had a big thing. So I did a whole bunch of stuff for aviation, which was a true love of mine, including passing a bill which limited product liability suits against airplane manufacturers in certain cases. And it impacted a lot of jobs. Pizza Hut was headquartered in my district, and I was able to get fresh pizza served in the school lunch program, which didn't happen before because of some crazy bureaucratic rules. So I did a lot of stuff that has impacted my district, the constituencies of my district. And then I was chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, so I was involved in national security issues and foreign policy issues as well. So I'm a kind of an eclectic guy. I like to do a lot of different things, and I was able to accomplish a lot during those years.
So when you served a number of years, and it came to the election that you lost, and you had some very interesting observations, it seemed like this was about the time that our politics changed. But share with us how somebody like you, who had a successful record as a middle of the road Democrat in a changing Republican state, lost the election.
Well, you had to bring that up, so I guess I'll have to talk about it. But the truth is that politics was changing. It was becoming more divisive between the political parties in the early 90s, and then we had these cultural issues, issues like guns, firearm regulation, and abortion. And these were cultural issues that tended to bring out a lot of very strong advocates. I was mostly on the progressive side of those issues, and so I had voted for firearms gun legislation back in 1994 that President Clinton had been pushing for, and I was pretty much on the pro-choice side of the abortion issues, and then the President Clinton had all these health care issues that were going on, and it was just my district was turning more and more to the right, to be honest with you, less and less Democratic. And so the last few elections had actually gotten closer, and so when the 94 election came along, I could sense that I might be in trouble. I was still did my best, and I still think I was a really good congressman, but the district turned much more conservative, and so I had to face that, and I lost. And it was tough for about 4 days. Then my dad said, get off your butt, go find something to do. And then about 3 weeks later, I get a call from President Clinton's chief of staff, Leon Panetta, said, do you want to be my Secretary of Agriculture? We got a better job with that.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is Dan Glickman, the author of a recent book called Laughing at Myself, My Education in Congress on the Farm and at the Movies. He's been talking a little bit about his early years and then his run for Congress. And that would be a lot for most people in their lives. But as you just mentioned, heading into our midpoint in the interview, you got right into a job in the administration of Bill Clinton as Agriculture Secretary.
Yeah, you know, I was. It would have been a job that probably would have voluntarily given up my congressional seat, but it would just turned out sometimes life serves you desserts when you don't expect it. And the then Secretary of Agriculture, his name was Mike Espy, a really nice guy, but he got in some trouble with some personal issues. He was ultimately vindicated, but there were some ethics issues. So he resigned, and the President Clinton nominated me for the job midterm. And I was supported by my Kansas delegation, including Senator Dole, who was the majority leader of the Senate. And so I took that job, and it was a really great job. It's a different kind of job, because I used to say in Congress you have a lot of responsibility and very little power. And in the USDA you have a lot of power but a little responsibility, because everything the president tells you to do, you sometimes, you know, have to carry the ball for the administration you're in. But in any event, it was a great job, huge portfolio from traditional agriculture programs to food safety to all the federal nutrition programs to global agricultural trade, a myriad of things. I had about 100,000 people that worked for me. And so it was a big management job, too.
I thought it was interesting about you were there, had a role in making farmers markets more widespread in the U.S.
Yeah, actually, when I was in the House, I was very involved in the Organic Standards Act legislation to create the organic food movement, and then I got involved in farmers markets because it was a good way to bring farmers and consumers directly together with each other, which wasn't happening enough, and that's expanded rather significantly, and I was real proud of that.
I noticed too in your time in Congress, you did vote for NAFTA, which became kind of a dirty word in some parts, especially with some of the old factory workers who lost their jobs. How do you look at that now, looking back, Dan? Was that was that a mistake, or did we not do enough to kind of help our factory workers? I know it was a boon for agriculture, obviously.
Yeah, I wasn't a mistake, but I mentioned abortion and guns. NAFTA was the other thing. NAFTA was very unpopular with a lot of the blue collar and Democratic base in my district, because I had all these aircraft workers, thousands of them, and they were very much against the North American Free Trade Agreement. And so it was it was the right vote, because it helped agriculture significantly. And what happened is that NAFTA became a synonym for about every bad thing that could happen to people. They blamed it on NAFTA. There's the old expression, "We had been NAFTA'd." Glickman, you NAFTA'd us, so to speak. But you know, the other thing that I think, by and large, it helped American farmers. But it was no cure-all for our economic problems that we were having. And I think the administration back then sold it as this was going to change dramatically the economic lives of people. And it helped, but it wasn't any kind of miracle either.
You had several key accomplishments there, a farm bill, but also a bill that perhaps was obscure to a lot of folks, involving African-American farmers.
Yeah, we did a lot. Well, the first day I came to the Department of Agriculture was in March of 1995, and there were pickets all in front of the USD headquarters from mostly African-American farmers claiming discrimination over many decades. I didn't cause it, but I saw very quickly that I was going to have to do my best to remedy it. And we found a lot of discrimination, particularly in the South, with respect to farm program implementation, farm loans that impacted minority farmers. And so we worked to try to help those problems, and that's been continued on, and Secretary Vilsack now has been working very hard on that issue as well. But never in my life did I expect that issue to in some sense, dominate my years at USDA.
You had a brief time spent at the Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government with some interesting students, and I'll let our listeners go get the book and read it to find out who they were. But I think it's fascinating how you, with your background in politics and government, then you're approached by a group representing our movies. That's a fascinating part of this tale.
Yeah, so I'd gone to Harvard. I couldn't get into Harvard as a student, so I got in through the back door later in life, and I ran this program involving actually politics and bipartisanship. And then one day I get a call from the head of the Motion Picture Association. His name was Jack Valenti, and he said, "Would you be interested in succeeding me?" He had been in that department, in that agency, in that association for a long time. He was basically chief lobbyist and spokesman for Hollywood. And I had a little bit of experience in intellectual property issues and film piracy when I was on the House Judiciary Committee, but I wasn't a movie guy, nor do I look like Tom Cruise. I can assure you that. He's got more hair than I do and better looking as well. I know more about agriculture than he does, however. So anyway, they wanted me in this job. I think Valenti wanted a cabinet-level person in the job to succeed him. He thought that would provide it more stature. My son, it turned out, was in the movie business. My son's been a film producer for many years. So I had a little bit of tie in that world. But I got this job. This guy who had been on the Agriculture Committee all these years became this chief spokesman for the movie industry. And I held that job for about 7 years. It was an interesting job. I would have to say that it was difficult and tedious sometimes to deal with these movie moguls. I did not really cavort with movie stars. I was more dealing with Washington legislative issues. But I did go to see a lot of movies. I went to a lot of these film festivals. And so I got some of the benefits of all that. But if I look back in my life, I would say that I probably enjoyed my time at the Department of Agriculture more than I did at the Motion Picture Association.
That was an interesting time because you served there starting in 2004 in the Bush administration. And, you know, obviously, I don't need to tell our listeners, you know, Hollywood's got a reputation for a left bent. How did you approach that with Republicans in charge? I mean, that had to have been kind of a challenge coming in as a Democrat yourself, middle-of-the-road Democrat. But how did you kind of approach that to help getting a working relationship with the other side in Congress?
Robin, in one word, carefully, I guess is the best answer. So I did my best to deal with Republican members of Congress. I contributed to a lot of their campaigns, and I contributed to a lot of their campaigns, and the movies are a big export item. You know, it's funny, agriculture, aviation, and motion pictures were at the time the three highest export items on America's trade balance surplus. And so it was really an important thing that I was part of that. But I always had to watch it. At first, when I got the job, there were some Republicans in Congress that thought that since they had the majority in Congress, that there should have been Republican in this particular job. But I handled it well. A lot of it was that not taking yourself too seriously. I did my best to talk to them, work with them, go out to dinner with them. And I had a lot of friends on the Republican side of the aisle, including the ones from Kansas that I had mentioned.
Looking back, Dan, as we kind of close here over the next couple minutes, what are some of the lessons here from your life to share with others? I think the sense of humor is great. I think more politicians need that. And you had a great quote from Eisenhower on how the sense of humor is a part of leadership, which I think a lot of our folks now forget. But we got into a bad spot here with the hyperpartisanship. There's a lot of concerns over the future of the country. What do we got to do to get back to, you know, get as close as we can back to the era where you were in Congress?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's no magic answer to this. One is the golden rule it still works. You know, do unto others as you'd want them to do unto you, and respecting other people's opinions, listening to them. Even if you don't agree with them, listening to them, you might find, you know, common ground. That's clearly a big part of it. You know, the whole idea of our national government and our democracy is based on consensus and reaching common ground. And it's not my way or the highway, which that's what the politics of today has become. It's my way or the highway. You either do it my way or else to hell with you. I don't want anything to do with you. And it's a real divisive situation. It's not good for the country. It's hurting us as a country, as a matter of fact. And, you know, there is no one thing to do, but it is to being a good person. I'm not saying I'm a perfect person, but being a good person then is probably the best advice I would give.
I got a couple minutes here, but I one of the themes of the show has been just rural politics. A lot of our audience, of course, is rural areas, and the Democrats, as you know, it's so changed so much where you were elected on the strength of the rural vote in Kansas in 1976, and now The Democratic brand is just really toxic in rural areas. What have the Democrats got to do to overcome that, or can they do
anything? It's a very good point, and it certainly isn't just agriculture policy, because actually there's a bipartisan agreement on most farm and agriculture programs. Part of it is just showing up. I remember both when Hillary Clinton, when she ran for president, the allegation was she didn't show up in rural areas and talk to farmers and ranchers and rural citizens. And half of life is showing up. Just being there is an important part of that deal. And I think President Biden has done a better job of this. I do think some of these cultural issues are at play. You know, firearms and abortion have become much bigger issues, for example, in the state of Kansas, now than they were 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. And those cultural issues kind of tend to dominate more than, you know, economic issues do. But I think the most important thing Democrats can do is show up and show that we care and just be around. And you know, we've got a tough economy now with inflation the way it is, gas prices, food prices. And it's an opportunity for Democrats if they just choose to take advantage of it.
Bipartisanship, sense of humor, and some common sense solutions, I think, are the trademark of your time in Congress. And I think there are excellent lessons to pass along for folks today in government and politics. Dan Glickman's been our guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of a book called Laughing at Myself, My Education in Congress on the Farm and at the Movies. I highly recommend it. What an interesting life and in twists and turns, and how you wound up in Hollywood, I think, is really interesting and worth folks taking a look at the book. But Dan, thank you so much for being our guest, and good luck.
Thanks, Robin, and thanks to all the good folks in Iowa and in your listening area, too.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Love Grows, the podcast, is all about storytelling and empowerment.
Our mission is to share a space for women and girls to talk about the stuff that matters to them most. Love speaks to the support we give each other as we search for our own path to success.
L, we can lead the way.
O,
overcome barriers.
V,
value each other.
E,
and empower each other. That's love.
Because every girl has a story.
And our stories matter.
Hey, this is Matt.
And I'm Joy.
Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to be a high-powered attorney, marketing guru, or entrepreneur?
If you have, we have a podcast just for you, and it's a real piece of work.
Come on, Joy, it's not that bad.
No, Matt, that's the name, A Real Piece of Work. It's the new job podcast for young people from WVIK and Junior Achievement of the Heartland.
Oh, nice.
Join us for A Real Piece of Work and get a jump start on your future.